From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, with its private jets and massive homes, Hollywood certainly contributes to climate change, but it's also trying to help. Then, with a chart-topping hit and a new movie on the way, we celebrate the summer of Lizzo.
What I love is that when people listen to my music, they put on a Lizzo suit or a Lizzo mask or a Lizzo mind frame, and they feel emboldened.
And John Paul White's latest album dives deep into his Southern roots. All that coming up on The Frame. A lot of people who work in Hollywood like to think of themselves as friends of the planet. But as is sometimes the case, those same folks might drive their massive SUV from some rainforest benefit to their private jet, which is about 10 times worse for the environment than flying commercially. But even if they don't always practice what they preach, movie and TV executives, writers, and directors are trying to use narrative and nonfiction stories to address climate change. Variety this week is publishing a special issue on Hollywood and the environment. Cynthia Littleton wrote the cover story for the trade magazine's Climate Crisis issue.
We started to notice that a lot of environmental and scientific advocacy groups were really trying to reach out to Hollywood writers, showrunners, screenwriters. There's almost a level of desperation in the scientific community. They've been sounding the alarm with reports and charts and data showing that we have, you know, barely 12 years to make changes that will slow the rate of global warming. And there's a feeling among groups like the Natural Resources Defense Council that Hollywood is almost the last-ditch effort. If we can raise some urgency via media and storytelling, then maybe we can galvanize some energy to make real, actionable change.
It also feels like there's a real tension. Obviously, Hollywood is in the business of selling movie tickets or getting TV ratings about what people want to watch and whether or not they want to see something that has a message and whether or not there's a way to slip those messages into stories that don't feel that heavy-handed. I remember doing a story about 10 years ago about the documentary The Cove, about the slaughter of Japanese dolphins, and it was a really important movie about what was happening in the world, and people didn't want to see it. So how much of that is a real tension of, like, trying to make sure that audiences are still intrigued by these stories and they don't feel like they're going to school?
Oh, that's absolutely a consideration. And, you know, no less a figure than James Cameron, the director of Avatar, who has been praised for really doing it in not a heavy-handed way, but in a way that enhances the storytelling and raises the stakes of the people thinking about this planet that we all share. Even he is a little skeptical as to, did it make a difference? It's 10 years later, and this was one of the most seen contemporary movies all around the world, and, you know, did it make a difference?
One of the things that I wonder is an issue as well is about whether or not Hollywood's own house is in order. I remember many years ago I was at Comic-Con and I was talking with somebody who worked with Cameron Diaz about coming back from San Diego on a Friday afternoon. The person said, oh, we're not driving, we're flying. And I was like, you're flying from San Diego to Los Angeles in a private jet with somebody, Cameron Diaz, who is out there talking about the environment. Is there a little hypocrisy in terms of how Hollywood lives and travels versus the messages it's trying to send in some of its entertainment?
There's no question that there has been a certain amount of do as I say, not as I do. I think in the past, Hollywood has a big platform, especially personalities now, where, you know, some top personalities have tens of millions of social media followers. And I think the hope is that small, achievable goals towards sustainability and green changes that people can make kind of in their daily lives can be effectively communicated through people that have, you know, lots of admirers. And that there's a feeling that there needs to be a galvanized sense, especially among younger voters in the U.S., that this is important, it needs to be addressed, and it can't be the science can no longer be a political football. There needs to be a coming together to find real large-scale solutions.
I also think it's true that in the past, Hollywood has done a pretty good job. I mean, certainly there are documentaries like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth.
If you look at the 10 hottest years ever measured, they've all occurred in the last 14 years. And the hottest of all was 2005.
That won the Best Documentary Feature Oscar. And then there's kind of what we'll call kind of lowbrow mainstream movies, like in Day After Tomorrow.
We've found something extraordinary. Extraordinary and disturbing, that is. You recall what you said about how polar melting might disrupt the North Atlantic current?
Yes.
Well, I think it's happening.
But it does feel like those are kind of the exceptions to the rules, that they are kind of one-offs, or those movies that have the most obvious environmental themes are ones that are not that frequent.
It's interesting. I spoke with a writer for the story, and she pointed out that a lot of our interest in vampire and zombie apocalypse-type movies are kind of a way of grappling with changes that we know are coming to the planet in a way that we wrap up climate change in the body of a zombie, and we can all understand that and understand that, you know, we want to get rid of the zombie. And that some of our shows, like The Walking Dead, like the Twilight features, could be seen as a kind of an allegory about fear of what's happening to the planet.
Tell us a little bit about what else is in the issue and how Variety is going to try to cover this story going forward.
There is certainly a matter of holding Hollywood's feet to the fire. It is an industry that does go through a lot of one-time sets. It goes through a lot of materials just in the course of making a movie and making a television show. So there's a lot that we can cover on a granular level. The bigger focus is if climate change related stories, big and small, are woven into popular movies and television shows, will it make a difference in terms of public opinion, feelings about policy and political matters as they relate to climate change?
Cynthia Littleton is Variety's business editor. Variety will publish its first ever climate issue on Tuesday. Cynthia, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks as always, John.
Coming up on The Frame, we visit with the siren of the summer, Lizzo. Lizzo is having a pretty good year. Her single, Truth Hurts, is number one on the Billboard Hot 100, and that makes her the first Black solo female R&B pop artist to top that list since Rihanna in 2012. Truth Hurts is on Lizzo's 2019 album, 'Cause I Love You, which Pitchfork calls a thesis on internalized and externalized confidence. The cover art reflects that. It features Lizzo in full body positive mode, posing naked and looking right at the camera. And the singer is also in the upcoming Jennifer Lopez movie, Hustlers, alongside Cardi B and Constance Wu. So today, we revisit the time we hung out with Lizzo in her Echo Park recording studio.
It's pretty, pretty here. And that's what I like about this studio is that, like, I feel like I'm in nature, so I'm not, like, in a casino of a studio where it's, like, I don't know what time of day it is and I have no connection to the earth.
It was October of 2017. Back then, Lizzo was about to go out on tour with her signature backup dancers, whom she calls the Big Girls.
I think that they're more of a quote-unquote spectacle than the, you know, size 2 super buff dancer that you see. I want the women who dance on stage with me to be an extension of me, to be my dream. Like, they dance like how I think I dance in my head. And I want them to be an example for anyone who doubts bigger women, who think that they can't be flexible, who think that they can't be spectacular and sharp.
I was thinking about this driving over here, that there's this idea that if you were to watch your show and not hear any lyrics, not even hear anything, that what you are saying by who you are and the way you're performing on stage says as much about who you are and what you have to say as your lyrics do. Do you buy into that? Do you think there's something true to that?
I mean, I think that's pretty cool. I feel like a lot of people who have an impact like that, it's never really intentional. Like, I didn't say, okay, being pantless on stage is going to be this statement. And it was like, no, I just didn't like wearing pants on stage. And I think I have really nice legs. And it's the era of the individual, you know. I think that we've been kind of homogenized and put in boxes and, like, socially taught that certain boxes are who we should be. And I think the individual is really starting to flourish, and the desire to be an individual is starting to flourish. And I think that's why people catch on to me.
I want
to
ask you about something that happened almost exactly a year ago. You went on Samantha Bee's Full Frontal. It was the night after the presidential election.
We are going to get up, change our pampers, brush off our shoulders, and push on through together. Please welcome Lizzo.
And you began your performance by singing Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is also known as the Black National Anthem.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty.
Was that something you planned to do? Obviously, you kind of rehearsed it. Why was that the right song at the right time?
I have been thinking about Lift Every Voice for a while. My old manager asked me, like, months earlier, like, would you ever sing the national anthem at, you know, a football game, or, like, so-and-so's been really interested, or, a basketball game? And I told him, yeah, I'll sing the national anthem, but I'm going to sing the Black national anthem. And I, like, said that initially, not as a joke. Everything I say kind of comes off, like, half joke, half, like, dead serious. But I said that, and ever since then, I've been thinking about it. Samantha Bee, we had had months and months and months of planning for that, you know? Like, the girls were wearing suits because we were going to have a whole power suit, like, montage of women in power suits. And we had, like, so much planned to, like, celebrate women and, like, the first female president, you know? And we were on the plane flying to New York, and I was watching the election on the back of someone's head. And I went to sleep, and I woke up in New York, and I woke up in a Trump presidency, and I had been thinking about it on the whole drive there and didn't really know. And then Samantha came in my dressing room, and she asked me, she was like crying. She was so devastated. And she was like, whatever you want to do, what do you want to do? And I was like, we're going to continue to do Good as Hell, because first off, I have a job to do. And also part of that job is to uplift people. So when I thought of Lift Every Voice, I asked her, I was like, well, anything? Can I do anything? Can you see if this is cleared? Can I sing this on television? And they just were like, we don't even care if you can't. And they did the research, and they were like, you can. And then I was like, okay, horns, just play this one note and I'll sing over that.
Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us.
I realize there's like two things. You can like watch history happen, or you can choose to be a part of it. And instead of ignoring it, I chose to engage in it.
On till victory is won.
Hey, the only person who can make America great is you. And if you feel me, I want everybody on your feet, because we're going to celebrate.
I wonder how much of your music and your art and everything you believe in is about empowering other people to live up to their potential and do what they can do to change the world, that you're not going to tell them what to do, but you're going to make them feel as if they have the opportunity to do that.
I think that's the reason why I am doing this.
If he don't love you anymore, walk your fine ass out the door.
A couple years ago, I decided to dedicate myself to positive music, because it's like, if I'm going to do this, I might as well make the world a little bit better. I never want to tell anyone what to do, because I don't want anyone preaching to me. I'm not a preacher. I'm a musician and I'm a singer. So what I love is that when people listen to my music, they put on a Lizzo suit or a Lizzo mask or a Lizzo mindset or mind frame, and they feel emboldened. But the reality is my music is what I'm going through, and I created to help myself. Like, I wrote Good As Hell a year ago to help me now, you know? I'm performing it on stage. I'm, like, so sad all day, and then I get on stage because it's my job, and as I'm singing Good As Hell sometimes, I'm just like, oh, I wrote this for me, you know? And I think that's super important. It's helped. I mean, right now we're at 2 million views, and I heard almost 10 million streams, which is massive for me, but on Spotify, but like all those millions of people are being helped, but I wrote it for me. Walk your fine ass out the
door. I want to ask you about your musical education, about the whole idea of growing up in a world in which Pentecostal gospel music was kind of what you knew, and when your ears and eyes were open, that there was a different way of using music to say something that was important.
I always knew that music was a vessel, because I used music as a vessel into religion, into Christianity, Pentecostal church. And then I used religion, Pentecostal church, as a vessel into spirituality. And then I realized spirituality and music came back full circle. So I realized that music is transformative, and all of my songs are a vehicle for change, for self-reflection, a vehicle for self-care, self-love, a vehicle definitely for self. And it's important. And I think that it was instilled in me as a child. I think I continue to have little eureka moments when people tell me what my song has done for them. The last time I heard something that was like, I was completely floored, was last year in Austin when I played Stubbs for South by Southwest for NPR. Someone came up to me and told me that they were transitioning from male to female. And when they listened to Excuse Me, it helped them during their transition. Ooh.
Look up in the mirror, oh my God, it's me. So much pride on me, I'm a prodigy.
Because when I say look up in the mirror, oh my God, it's me, she would look in the mirror during her transition and see this person. And would be like sometimes shocked at who she was becoming, sometimes excited, sometimes unsatisfied and wanted more, but mostly just like appraising herself and praising herself. And that for me was like, yo, people are taking this music and traveling so far with it. You know, they're flying with it. And that's why I continue to do it.
Lizzo, thanks so much for coming on The Friend.
Thank you.
Lizzo appears in the movie Hustlers. It opens on September 13th. In October, she's playing three shows at the Hollywood Palladium. Coming up on The Frame, singer-songwriter John Paul White proves that you can go home again. The guitarist Jimmy Johnson died last week. He wasn't a household name, but he was a key member of a studio band known as the Swampers that played on countless hit songs recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And that's where singer-songwriter John Paul White recorded his latest solo album called The Hurting Kind. It's a throwback to White's country-politan influences, and he collaborated with veteran Nashville songwriters and more recent arrivals to the Music City scene. White spoke with The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett about growing up a stone's throw away from the Fame recording studios in Muscle Shoals.
Until I was a teenager, I was almost completely unaware of the Shoals thing, even though it was 20 minutes down the road. I remember driving by Fame Studios and my mom mentioning, hey, that's a recording studio over there. I said, well, what'd they record there? And she thought for a second. She said, the Osmond Brothers. And that's all she told me. Not Aretha, not Wilson Pickett, Clarence Carter. And I was suitably impressed.
There's walls around the walls around my heart.
I mean, I wasn't under a rock. I knew some of those songs, but I didn't realize that. Two things. I didn't realize how much had come from that area, and I also, at some point, didn't realize that that was strange. I just thought everybody's community made music like that. So we played up and down the Tennessee-Alabama state line. Well, Alabama was dry at the time, so everybody came up to where I lived to play. So I would go play a gig with my friends, and David Hood of the Swampers would be there, or Roger Cook or Roger Clark, Jimmy Johnson, Spooner Oldham. I'd be in a field on a flatbed trailer out in the middle of nowhere. And Spooner Oldham be there and just start chatting me up and talking about, I really like your music, man. Where are you from? And I didn't know until later that he had just come home from playing with Neil Young. And this started becoming normal, that these were the people I was surrounded by and who I was learning from and who I had to be as, you know, on par with to get a gig. The learning curve was really steep. My mom says the first song she remembers me singing other than a church song was Rhinestone Cowboy.
Well, hello, my name is James.
James was inspired by Glen Campbell.
I used to be great at faces and things, but they don't stick like before.
When he got diagnosed and we all knew that he was dealing with, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's, that was hard to watch. He'd finish a song and then he'd count that same song off to play it again because he didn't know he'd just played it.
I remember my GTO. I'd race it down Rabbit Trail Road.
And so Rabbit Trail Road is where he grew up, and he used to race for Pink Slips. The last race he was in, he flipped his car about four times and lived and said, yeah, okay, that's good. There's the sign. But it's a song that every night I have a conversation with someone after a show about, because everyone's touched by that disease.
Heaven we already met. It seems we have by this photograph sitting beside me.
I have fought with myself over the years about voicing too much of my opinions on the world at large, and I try to do it in song, and I try to be subversive about it, and I'm in awe of people that are out there and wear it on their sleeve. My skin's pretty thin. I don't really love conflict, and so I've always been really apprehensive about it, but with the song The Good Old Days, it was just a direct comment on the whole idea of making America great again, because I'm from Alabama.
There's something going down in this simple place I grew up in.
A lot of my friends, when things happened down there, like the recent voting about abortion rights, they all message me. They're like, dude, what's going on? You know, where's your head at on this? And I don't take that lightly. And so if I'm asked, I'll tell you how I feel about it.
Oh, I'm so good, I'm at the good old days.
I talk about this during the show. I was raised by incredibly strong women, and it made me who I am today. And the idea that anybody should tell women they shouldn't make their own decisions about their body or anything else, I think that's ridiculous. I miss my kids. I miss my wife. This is hard work, getting in the van every day and sleeping in a different hotel every day. And so the only thing that gets me out here doing it is that raw emotion I feel, and also talking to people after shows and finding out that a song like James helps them. I don't understand Mick Jagger and Springsteen, but if this is why they do it, I do understand. The reason I'm doing it is to connect with people and for no other reason.
What a wicked world in all its fairy tales.
And that's it for today. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center. To fall on